KALW.
The main concern is not about when they're walking down the street, whether they're going to get shot.
Oakland's District 7 is electing a new council member this year.
Is whether they're going to be able to have enough money by the end of the week to pay for their basic services.
Today, what residents want city leaders to do in order to make their lives better. Then, what does it feel like when someone you trust pulls you away from your loved ones and home?
Somewhere, somehow, he took it upon himself to take us away.
And an Oakland-based photographer makes a living taking photos of food.
Ice cream is known to be like the hardest thing to shoot. It melts in seconds.
Eating with your eyes. I'm Suni Khalid in for Hana Baba, and this is Cross Currents. Oakland's District 7 City Council seat is up for election in November. Candidates hoping to serve these voters have their work cut out for them. KALW's executive producer Ben Trefney spoke with Oaklandside reporter Jose Formoso. He covers road safety, transportation, and public health. He recently spoke to residents in Oakland's District 7.
Can you describe the community in East Oakland's District 7, the demographics, diversity, and socioeconomics there?
It's a very diverse community of people. The district actually runs from the shoreline near the Oakland International Airport, now known as the San Francisco Bay International Airport. The industrial flatlands goes through the green Oakland Hills up in the north. So you have a lot of wealthy people. You have people living in extreme poverty. You have a lot of small businesses, a lot of restaurants. You have people that have just moved into Oakland. And people that have lived there for generations, living in the exact same homes that their grandparents lived in. So you have a lot of different types of people, not a lot of them mixed together, because there's still a lot of separation based on where they live. In general, most people that are wealthy in this district live in the hills, and a little bit more African-Americans, Latinos, a lot of immigrants, a lot of Southeast Asian immigrants in the flatlands of Oakland.
You were speaking with community members about some of their top concerns right now and as we approach the election with a new council person to be voted on. So what are some of the top concerns that you heard?
The most important concern people had was about their day-to-day economic living. They were concerned about keeping their jobs or getting a job. They were concerned about the cost of goods. Whether at the grocery store or at the pump, they were concerned about the cost of rent. When we're talking about a lot of the low-income people in Oakland, these people that are doing low-income jobs, there's a lot of labor, a lot of construction workers that live there. I think a lot of us have the understanding that there is a lot of crime in Oakland and in East Oakland in particular, and that is the case, and people are worried about that. But the main concern is not about when they're walking down the street, whether they're going to get shot, is whether they're going to be able to have enough money by the end of the week to pay for their basic services. A lot of the low-income people that I talked to had that concern, but also people that are a little bit more middle-income. I mean, there's just this sense of fear around how much money they have and whether it's going to be enough to live here.
Those seem like pretty typical Bay Area concerns where the cost of living is so high generally, but also I think that's reflective of Americans' concerns in general, really. Just like, you know, because when we talk about presidential politics, the economy is almost always the top consideration for voters.
That's right. I actually spoke to one man who runs a mobile tire shop business. So like when somebody's truck or car needs help with AAA to have a replacement with their tires, somebody calls that guy and shows up to help out the AAA to put in new tires. And he said that just over the last 5 years, notwithstanding the pandemic, that his business has basically collapsed to like 60 or 70%. And he still maintains the same relationships with the same people that are providing the tire service. So he's like, I mean, this is the only thing I've ever done over the last 35 years since coming here from Mexico as an immigrant. And so he's obviously concerned about what's happening. We don't necessarily know why his business has changed so much. It also might be the market. So these are really difficult issues. And I think people are also just confused. They don't really know who to ask or like who to blame the situation on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's seeking hope from wherever they could find it. One thing that has changed, of course, in the last decade specifically, maybe even 5 years, is the driver that was the whole Coliseum complex for economic activity in East Oakland and in District 7 there. The Raiders left, the Warriors left, the A's are leaving. This provided a lot of traffic in and out all the time, a lot of jobs. How do you see the impact of the loss of this driver on this community?
The actual Coliseum site is no longer on District 7. Now it's on District 6. The line now is surrounding on the east side of the Coliseum. So the question that you posed is still very important, because the Coliseum itself, it also brought in a lot of different businesses. It's still a gigantic worry. Whenever I was walking around, even deep into District 7, people did bring up the Coliseum and what's going to happen there. Obviously, they're sad about what happened, and they are concerned about the economic fallout in all of the neighborhoods surrounding the Coliseum. At the same time, they also have been paying attention. Recently, the Coliseum was bought by a Black-led coalition of people that say they're going to develop it. It was really interesting to see that they're following that story, and that they're interested in potentially seeing this gigantic piece of land, which is on District 6, how it might affect 6 and 7 and all the people surrounding it, and seeing it as something to look forward to, something positive that could lead to improved and economic future there in DP Stokeland. At the same time, whenever that happens, that's going to be years down the line. I mean, the transaction just happened about a month ago, right? So in the immediate future, they still have the same concerns. The Oakland Roots are going to move in there. This is the soccer team. The Oakland A's, even though they were not getting a lot of fans into the stadium anymore, they still had 81 dates out of the 365 days of the year. The Oakland Roots have about a quarter of that. And there's a lot of excitement around that team, the potential economic influence that it might have on that neighborhood is yet to be seen. When they were in a small stadium in Laney next to Lake Merritt, there was a lot of excitement, but we don't really know whether that caused a lot of economic development. But yeah, when it comes to the Coliseum, I think people are excited, but they understand that it's going to take a long time and for the larger development there, and they need help now. They want some more services. They want more economic help.
That was Oakland Side reporter Jose Formoso speaking with KALW's executive producer Ben Shrefty. You can find all our election coverage at kalw.org/2024elections. You've been listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Sunni Khalid in for Hana Baba. Imagine being a young kid growing up in California. One day, out of nowhere, you're suddenly uprooted and dropped into a world where everything feels different. Language, customs, even family. This was one man's childhood. He says his father took him and his siblings from their home in the U.S. and brought them to Mexico. They were left to live with grandparents who never had planned on raising them. From inside Solano State Prison, Uncuffed producer Anthony Ivey brings us the story of a young boy who learned how to survive in a place that felt foreign and somehow also familiar. And just a note, we have chosen not to name the person you'll hear in this story to protect the identity of his family members.
I was 8 years old at that time. That's when things happened with my dad and my mom. They got into an argument. Some way, somehow, he took it upon himself to take us away. That's when everything started. He started packing everything up, telling us that we're going to go to Disneyland. You know, you're a little kid, you hear that stuff and it makes you feel like, okay, you know, like yeah, we're going to Disneyland. There's four of us. My sister, she's a year younger than me. My little brother, at that time, he was like two. When we got to the airport, it's like, we're going to Mexico. And we're like, what? As soon as I met his mom, she was a hard character, man. She's no joke, like ruthless. She's my grandma, and then I met my grandpa. We did ask her, I said, what's going on with my mom? Is she gonna come? I said, nah, you're not gonna see her. Like, don't worry about her. My dad was right there with us until the day that my dad decided to tell us. He's like, hey, I'm leaving. So we're like, all right, yeah, we're leaving, you know, we're good, hell, you know? He's like, nah, you guys don't understand. I'm leaving. You guys are staying behind. And that's when that everything sunk in. And that's like my whole world crashed because it's my dad. He meant everything to me, man. And it broke me. Once the next day, right, we fell asleep, he's just gone. And that's when everything, it went bad. The true colors of my grandma and my grandpa, they came out. First day that I saw them, they slapped my sister. My little brother, he was like, he's, you know, like the little baby fat diaper. She just called him a fat ass. She wasn't gonna feed him until he loses weight. And I'm the oldest one. I'm overprotective of them till this day. I was one of the best for them, so I stood up. And I'm like, hey, don't touch my brother. Then that's when they hit me too. And told me like, hey, right here, you're gonna learn Spanish. You're gonna become a man. And right here, you're gonna work. Otherwise, you don't eat. None of you. Every time that my brother or my sister, they would try to hit him, I'll step up and I get the worst of it. And we ain't talking no hands. Nah, we're talking about cables, pieces of metal, and all going through your back, you know? Oh, it was rough. As soon as I go to school, all the kids looked at us and they started to talk to us like, hey, I'm just like, oh, hi, hello. And they start calling us name, like what? Like Plastico, like plastic, whitewash and everything, right? Like, then like, oh, you guys are little gringos. So I couldn't realize at first, they're like, why are you talking, you know, are you talking Spanish? Like, we're equal, we're the same, you know, we're same race. But I guess this out there in Mexico is because we didn't grow up with them. We just like, for them, we're just tourists. Every Monday, they gather all the school and they put them in the patio. And then they start doing the, like in the US, where every time that you go for the a Pledge of Allegiance of a flag. So me, coming from over here, and I started singing the Mexican anthem. I didn't know it. At first, I was just like standing and I was trying to like mumble words and stuff. And I remember the kids looking at me and just punching at me and saying, shut up, you're Mexican. I made it my mission. And like to this day, every time that a Mexican team plays, they always play the Mexican anthem. I always sing it. Mexicanos al grito de guerra, el acero a pesar y el bridón. All of a sudden, we got a letter. Grandma, she called me. She's like, hey, there was a letter from your dad. He's in prison. And then I remember that day, their faces, they got mad. Because then now they said, like, why are we going to take care of these kids? Not even ours. Now we have more mouths to feed. Where are we going to get the money? Put them to work. They got to earn that. I kept on asking, okay, so what about my mom? I told my grandma, like, where my mom's at? And I remember that day too that my grandma told me like, okay, if your mom really wanted you guys, she would have came and picked you guys up. So what does that tell you? So I kind of started hating my mom. Like, you know what? It makes sense. How come, you know, she's going to live with these monsters? I'm not going to lie to you, man. There was plenty of times that I wanted to run away. But then I looked at my brother. I looked at my sister. I looked at my cousins. And they're like, man, don't leave us, man. Like, please don't leave us. And he held me back every time. And I was like, nah, I can't do that. They really mean a lot to me, man. It took 4 years, man. I don't know how exactly, but my mom made it happen. they found us. And I remember that day because we were in school. We were in school, and I remember we just see these people coming into the classroom. You could tell they're from USA because they're white. And they came in with their suits and everything, you know, like they told the teacher, hey, we're looking for so-and-so. And when they said my name, I got up. And they said, come on, let's go. I was like, what? And they just looked at them, and it's like, tears just start coming in my eyes. Finally, like, hey, we're going back. And they're like, hey, come on, man. Your mom's here. She wants to see you guys. And I told them, no, I don't want to see that lady. And she's like, well, why not? Because I hate her. Like, why she left us? Like, she just left us to be right here the whole time. And they opened the door. And I remember seeing my mom coming in crying. Like, she was really crying. She just, like, looked at my sister and looked at my brother, looked at me, and my little sister, my little brother, they ran towards her, you know, and hugged her and crying, mom, you know. And my mom, she just hugged them. She just looked at me. At first, I was just like mad, still angry, like looking at her, but I just couldn't contain myself. I just started crying too. And I did. I ran up to her and I hugged her. And she told me that she was sorry. And then she started telling me her story. What happened? And then I was like, man, I got played all over from the beginning till the end, because now I'm listening to my mom's version. For 4 years, she said that she'd been looking for us, searching for us. And that she even got my dad locked up. She, you know, she found him and told him, like, hey, man, give me my kids. He told her, if you drop the charges right now, I'll tell you where they're at. She did exactly that. And my dad took her to a room and beat her up. I don't feel no resentment towards my dad because he thought at that moment it was the right decision. Because later on he learned, he heard everything that happened to us. He didn't even know like everything that we went through. When he heard that, he said that he cried and he wanted to apologize. And maybe I am the way I am today. I get angry or whatever, right? Or I got issues. I'm glad that not a lot of people go through it, but there might be some people in the world that know exactly how it feels. And they never had a chance to speak up about it. Like me, this is my first time actually talking about this publicly because I never had a chance, you know, like to actually express to somebody else, you know, just things that happened. I'm thinking like maybe this happened to other people as well. Speaking about it here and there, it'll help you heal.
That story was produced by Anthony Ivey, who was an Uncuffed producer inside Solano State Prison. Good news, he's now back home and working with Uncuffed on the outside. He's also a fellow with this year's Audio Academy. Excited to hear more of your work, Ivey. Our work in prisons is supported by the California Arts Council and the Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. The producers fact-check content to the best of their ability. All content is approved by an information officer. Hear more by subscribing to Uncuffed in any podcast player. This is Cross Currents. I'm Suni Khalid in for Hana Baba. Oakland's Chava Oropesa is one of the people to blame for your hunger. He works behind the camera to capture those delicious pictures. His mother's dishes, along with growing up in Mexico City, influenced his artistry and love for food. Chava spoke with KALW's Janae Darden.
Chava, welcome.
Hi, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Your work is so beautiful, and I can definitely see the influence of your background and your work. I could see the energy and the color. And of course, Mexico has some of the best food on the planet.
For sure.
Yes. Okay. So.
Yes.
I was teasing you before we started the interview. I said, you get us in trouble because when we're trying to... Sometimes, not all your photos are like this, but I'm like, I don't need a donut. And then I see a picture of a donut and it's chocolate dripping.
Yep, that happens.
And
I'm like,
and I got an apple in my hand with that chocolate dripping off that donut, Chava. And you know, you're doing your job and you do a good job. So what all entails, what are the variables, what all entails to, you know, making a really good shot of food?
It's very much a big collaborative work. And for example, I work with food stylists, I work with prop stylists, photographer assistants, digitechs. I can't break it down what it is so I can explain it. But obviously, the food stylist is in charge of making the food look good, making it look pretty and bright and fresh, or anything that needs to happen. The prop stylist helps with anything that's going to be a plate, glass, a spoon, an item, anything that's going to help dress up the scene. And then I come in place to light up the scene and kind of define where, how's the angle, how is it going to be shot, how is it going to be lit, how is it going to be shown. It is a big collaborative effort. It's not only me. Sometimes with some clients, it's only me and I have to do all these little jobs myself. And sometimes with larger clients, it's a crew of 10 people or something like that. So it very much depends.
So often when I go to a restaurant,
yep,
my dish may not look like what's on the poster or on the commercial or on the menu. Yep. So, and I've watched documentaries about how, I don't know if the right term to say, food models are kind of enhanced. What are some of the things that you all do to enhance the image of the food, the beauty of the food?
Got it. Yeah. So I think first I want to kind of disperse a big myth that's going out there, which is, I've been, some people ask me like, oh, is it true that you use glue instead of milk? Is it true that you use shaving cream instead of whipped cream?
Right, I've heard
all
that.
those little videos are out there explaining all these odd techniques. So first of all, legally you cannot do any of those things, because it is misrepresentation. So if I'm shooting, if I'm shooting ice cream, there's a way to make fake ice cream, which looks like real ice cream, but obviously holds up better on set, and it doesn't melt faster. If I'm a company that's selling ice cream, legally I cannot use fake ice cream. That's a no. You can get sued, you can get in trouble. If I'm a company that's selling ice cream syrup, I may be able to use fake ice cream because I'm using the real syrup. So as long as what you are selling is the real product, you can do certain things to enhance that food item.
So on May 23rd, 2024, Google displayed your chilaquiles photo on their homepage. And chilaquiles is a Mexican breakfast dish. When I saw it, I said, oh my goodness, it looks so good. It's like corn tortilla strips and chiles on there and salsa and cheese and cream and yummy, 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 all kind of good stuff. I was like, oh, that's a hearty breakfast dish. I think you could put some chicken on it if you want.
Yes.
Yeah, that'll get you through the day. And I looked at it and I said, oh, if I saw that in the morning, I'd be going down the street to my one of my favorite Mexican restaurants. Why did you, I don't know, did Google choose that dish or did you choose that dish to be for the Google Doodle for that day?
Google contacted me and reached out to me to offer me this project. They were looking to create this doodle specifically with chilaquiles, specifically for this day. So they reached out to me and they asked me if I would be interested and wanted to do this project with them. They let me know. This is the first time they've actually done any doodle with photography, because all their doodles are illustrations. And I shot the dish with the chilaquiles and the tortilla strips. And yes, they were real. The letters are real tortilla strips. I was cutting them with my little X-Acto knife. I fried them and shot the whole thing. It took me a day to shoot it. And also kind of like animated. And once everything was completed and done, we delivered everything to the Google team, and it was scheduled for May 23rd, and it got published. It was pretty awesome, and I was very proud of actually producing something that represented Mexican food and Mexican culture, and I enjoyed it a lot. The plate that I use is one of the plates that my mom actually bought me. And so even having that as a part of the project was really meaningful to me.
That was food photographer Chava Oropesa speaking with KALW's Janae Darden. We'll have a link to his delicious work at kalw.org/crosscurrents. This interview was produced by Porfirio Rangel. The Cross Currents team includes Demetrius Johnson, Leon Morimoto, Crystal Rahim, James Rowlands, Ganedi Joe Johnson, Victor Tentz, Molly Blair Salyer, Shireen Adel, Hanisha Harjani, Lisa Morehouse, Angela Johnston, Marissa Ortega Welch, and Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Sunil Khalid.